Welcome to Great Ideas, broadcast on WKXL and available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matt Robeson, and today, the economy, controlling rising and high inflation and threading the needle of preventing ourselves from falling into a recession. It's the most vexing policy question in America and indeed around the world. And the options open to policymakers are limited. But there are things that policymakers can do. And a number of proposals have come out recently for tamping down inflation and trying to thread that needle. We wanted to ask a great economic expert about what the options are and what the best options could be. And we have one with us today. Zach Moeller is the director of Third Way's Economic Program. He is a veteran of a staff position in Congress. In his 3 years on the Senate Budget Committee, he worked on economic and revenue issues under chairs Patty Murray and Ken Conrad. His work has been previously featured in the New York Times, The Economist, The Financial Times, and MSNBC. Zach, welcome to Great Ideas.
I'm happy to be here, Matt.
Well, it's delightful to have you. It's kind of dismal to talk about the risk of recession and high inflation. Obviously, it's bumming everybody out. We see this in surveys that despite the fact that we actually have quite a mixed economic situation right now, surveys show that people are quite downbeat about the state of the economy. So the mixed picture includes very low unemployment, a high number of job opportunities. And yet what people are reporting back to public opinion researchers is they feel worse about the current state of the economy than they did during the Great Recession. And obviously the number one culprit is inflation. So first of all, just to start at a very high level, what is the state of the economy? Is it as terrible as people's feedback to pollsters would make it seem? Is it that kind of mixed picture I laid out? What's your view on it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think as someone who's trained in economics, I think of everything as a balance. On one side of it, you are absolutely right, Matt. There are a lot of job openings for people who want good paying jobs. The unemployment rate is really low. Growth had been relatively substantial until kind of recent data releases. But on the other side of it, inflation has been high, it has been growing, and hopes that it was finally leveling off seem to have been a little misplaced. I think everyone is particularly pessimistic because unlike unemployment, inflation affects everybody. Everybody is feeling inflation. And so that is causing a general state of anxiety about the economy in a particular moment where unemployment might be a little high. Well, the people that are unemployed are certainly stressed out about the economy, but people with a job are a lot less stressed about the economy. So if, you know, the economy improves from 6% unemployment to 4% unemployment, about 2% of the people are made absolutely better off. And then there's, you know, some additional effects that go through. But 100% of people are feeling inflation right now.
It's a very weird thing because, of course, we think about the economy as, to use a $10 word, something exogenous, something that, you know, exists on its own. But it's really just the aggregation of a whole lot of individual human psychology that then becomes kind of mass psychology. And there's a lot of that kind of Shakespeare phrase, there's nothing that's good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And in a very real way, when it comes to an issue like inflation, our expectations of what's going to happen and our appraisal of the situation really matters. If we think that there's going to be more inflation, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about in economics whether or not inflation expectations are well anchored. I'm actually, you know, your listeners won't see this, but my shirt has little anchors on it today for the fact that we want to talk about well anchored inflation expectations. You can think of inflation expectations, to use the phrase the youth are using today, the vibes of the economy.
I suspect that you're more youthful than I am, but go on.
Well, I've now just hit middle age at 35, and so I'm feeling like I need to talk about the youths.
Only if your life expectancy is 70, man.
Well, I hope it's more than that. So, you know, clearly the vibe of the economy and how people think about inflation matters. Mm. If you are a worker and you have well-anchored inflation expectations, high inflation, high gas prices is a shock. It's not good, but you don't think, I need to be planning for this for my next job, for the next year, so on and so forth. If you are making purchases, if you work for a business and you are making purchases, you don't need to be planning, I need to make sure that I have a big stock today because everything is going to be more expensive tomorrow. If you are hiring people, you don't need to be planning that wages are just going to keep going up and up and up. So that is why when those expectations get unanchored and everyone thinks inflation is just the state of the world now, that's the vibe. That is when, you know, inflation becomes more of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, that's so interesting, because the reason I raise that is that often what you do, you know, what we used to think about as we're both veterans of being congressional staffers. And so what you think about is you think about policy terms and you think in very concrete terms, especially in your position working on the budget committee. You think about, we're going to spend money on program X or facility Y. You're putting hard dollars into real things. But in a very real way, the challenge to policymakers now with our current state of the economy is much more psychological. It's much more about getting the vibe right. And so when we think about what the folks in Washington can do, it does come down to issues of confidence and anticipation and how people are thinking about their current situation and the future. It's a very weird alchemy that they have to pull off. And I think it's an interesting contrast when you talk to an economist. So for example, on the Beyond Politics show last week, we had Mark Zandi, the noted economist from Moody's Analytics, and he presented a really compelling case, and there's a ton of modeling data to back this up, that the drivers of inflation right now come down basically to the pandemic, so supply chain disruptions, the mismatch of supply and demand that we've seen over the last couple of years that's built up, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is most acutely felt in energy prices and now in food prices. That's what's causing inflation. Those are kind of real world, real economy impacts that are causing inflation to be high. But again, when we think about remedies from a policy sense, what we have to deal with is people's expectations and their level of confidence. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right to some extent, right? There are other policy things that are not based on confidence and how people necessarily feel about the economy that we can do, right? There, if supply chains are an issue, then let's make policy to smooth out the rough patches in our supply chains. Hmm. For example, you know, the chassis in which you put a truck on is a good that is essential to moving things across the country, whether it's on trains or whether it's on trucks. We have a shortage of those. So that means that things are moving slower than we would necessarily want. And so policymakers could make changes to tariff laws, for example, to reduce the cost of importing more chassis so that we have them available to kind of solve this one small piece of the supply chain issue crisis that we're facing. So policymakers can do things. They're just not going to, it's not the big exciting thing that we kind of see when we talk about monetary policy and its role in dealing with inflation.
Right. And I do want to get to that distinction between monetary and fiscal policy. And just to kind of put a bow on the discussion of the drivers of inflation, because I do think it kind of matters in thinking about the remedies that you bring to bear. Is that how you see it? That the drivers are basically the pandemic and the Russian invasion. I'm not trying to do an exercise in blame storming here, like it's not Joe Biden's fault, but that it does matter if you know what the causes are before you address the symptoms.
Yeah, I think about a track meet, for example. We are at a track meet. It's an Olympic track meet. All the countries are lined up, and we're about to run the inflation race. The starter gun that goes off, that is COVID. That is what is kicking it all off. Now, how fast anyone is running that race depends on a whole lot of variety of other issues. The U.S. is out ahead in this inflation race because we have the strongest economy, because we did the right things to strengthen the economy. But now we're seeing the drawbacks of that particular approach. So yes, COVID and, you know, Vladimir Putin's invasion of the Ukraine are absolutely key and are very, very strong drivers of this. The comparative levels of what we're seeing in Europe versus what we're seeing here, that stuff on the margin is other things that are going on, whether it's our particular labor market, our particular economic strength, how we've successfully and not successfully dealt with COVID in various ways, and the particular response mechanisms that we've had from federal policymakers.
Right. So the very fact, one of the indicators that our economic situation is actually somewhat stronger today than, for example, on the cusp of the Great Recession in 2008, is that our median bank accounts are so much higher. We have much more resources individually to spend. And indeed, consumer spending has remained strong. But that in itself also has the downside that our spending and is out of whack with supply. So demand is mismatched with supply because of supply chain constraints and therefore inflation.
Right, exactly. We have too much money chasing too few goods. That is a supply component, the too few goods piece, and the demand component, too much money. But it would be tough to tell somebody, you have too much money. That's just a losing political message. But yes. that's the only thing that we're hearing from Republicans is, well, actually, it's Biden's fault because we've had too strong of an economic recovery. So it does need to be a balance. We need to make sure that the Fed is doing its stuff. We need to make sure that we're not making problems worse, which means paying for additional legislation. And we need to be addressing supply chain issues and other broader production issues in the United States.
And believe me, I would love to litigate. This would actually be a fun episode to do, maybe in Beyond Politics, to litigate. Wait, I just want to understand the argument that we passed $5 trillion of COVID-related anti-recession measures, $1 trillion of it under Biden, but it's Biden's fault somehow from a policy standpoint. Anyway, we could do that till the cows come home. Yeah. You alluded before to another highfalutin word, monetary policy. And I do want to get into that distinction for our listeners. Many of our listeners are probably familiar with this, but there are two general toolkits available to the federal government when it comes to managing inflation and generally managing the economy, fiscal policy and monetary policy. Can you explain the distinction there and generally how they work?
Sure, absolutely. So fiscal policy is what, you know, more or less Congress is doing and the president is signing into law, right? It is taxes. It is federal government spend. You hear about it all the time. You see it every time you get a paycheck. You know, that's a tax, you know, some taxes are coming out of that. You see it every time, you know, your postman comes to your door. You know, that's a form of federal government spending. That's out there. Monetary policy is a lot less visible in everyone's everyday lives, because monetary policy, and this is the Federal Reserve and their role in the banking sector, provides this kind of more behind the scenes effect on how interest rates are changing throughout the economy. Now, interest rates are generally affected in the open market, right? You know, you buy and sell treasury bonds in financial institutions. You know, your mortgage is repackaged and sold to, you know, someone in finance. And the Federal Reserve plays a role in managing what's going on there and setting kind of the low risk or risk-free ways that banks may need to borrow overnight, or they themselves can get into the market and be a purchaser or a seller of various bonds, which could raise bond prices, raise interest rates, or lower bond prices and lower interest rates. And so at the start of the pandemic, the Federal Reserve used a lot of monetary policy to lower interest rates, to make it easier to borrow, and to just generally calm out the financial institutions to make sure that they didn't overreact to the stress of the COVID pandemic. And now that we have high inflation, the Fed's doing the opposite. It's like, all right, well, I got to step in and raise interest rates, kind of slow everything down to make sure that inflation just doesn't get out of control.
And I want to commend to all of our listeners, if you're interested in this topic of how does this really work? How does the Fed control inflation? How do they try and adjust all of those levers that they have at their disposal? We did a great episode about this in the Great Ideas podcast feed with Steve Robinson, who is the chief economist at the Concord Coalition. He's also another Capitol Hill veteran like us, and he got into all the ins and outs of that. So I commend that to everyone. It was really interesting. It was a lot of economic history, how we left the gold standard, how things have changed over the last 100 years or so. And we get into all of those details. But the bottom line, it sounds like, Zach, is, you know, just what you just said. We lower interest rates, try to goose the economy as the recession, the COVID-induced recession was setting in. And now the reversing course just raised rates 0.75%. But the risk here, it sounds like, and you can read this ad nauseum and all the coverage, the risk is you go too far and you create a recession. And in fact, Larry Summers, who we're going to return to, the former Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard, a noted economist in his own right, said we are going to have an extended period of high average unemployment to bring inflation under control. So it's a really, really fine line to walk here, it sounds like, where you need to get just the right amount of cool down without, you know, Larry Summers was talking about you could have a year with 10% unemployment, which would be really massive. So, I mean, is that essentially what's going on here? Is the Fed is now trying to thread that needle?
Well, I mean, it's like Goldilocks, right? You want to make sure that the economy is not too hot, not too cold, not too soft, not too hard, right? You're absolutely right. It is a bit of a tightrope, though. At any given time, the tightrope could be pretty wide. It could be pretty narrow. It could be wide and getting narrower, or narrower getting wider. It's really uncertain. And that's part of why the Federal Reserve is tasked with mandate for both stable prices and full employment, is they are a lot more nimble than Congress can be. You know, you and I have worked for Congress. They can spend plenty of time.
That's damning with faint praise there.
Yeah. You know, they can spend a lot of time debating what the right approach is going to, it needs to be. And then they have to negotiate between the two parties to get something together. And then they don't necessarily want to pay political costs on the other end. So the Federal Reserve is above that. And that is why they can be more nimble and try to do the fine tuning of the economy. You know, Chairman Powell was absolutely right for being very aggressive to fight. And he was very right at the time, thinking that inflation was going to be transitory. But then he was right until he was wrong. And now we are at this point where, okay, well, now we're on the other side of it and we need to be fighting inflation a little bit more. And I think the 75 basis point move shows how serious the Federal Reserve is taking it. That on itself is not going to induce a recession, but we'll see how that kind of plays out, because high and sustained inflation, when we unanchor those inflation expectations that we were talking about earlier, that's when we're going to have a real bad time. And that would cause the recession needed to be substantially more. So I think we can maybe get to this Goldilocks scenario, but I can't guarantee that we are.
Right. And I mean, that is the danger, right? Which is, I grew up in the 70s where we had very different inflation expectations, but there are now whole cohorts of Americans who are like, what is this thing? And if they begin to get inured to it and they begin to expect it, it could become a self-fulfilling prophecy. A lot of badness goes down that road. Well, let's talk about some of those options on the fiscal policy side, the kinds of things that Congress can do, the president can do. Now, there was a new report that came out from the new Democratic coalition that kind of gave a menu of options. It was widely praised, including by former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who I mentioned a moment ago. He thought that this list of options was very valuable and should receive, in his words, urgent policy consideration. It was also widely praised by previous guests on this show, like LaDonna Mahdi, our previous guest, Ben Ritz from the Progressive Policy Institute, our previous guest. So it kind of got my attention as maybe this is a good starting place to work down these suggestions. And Zach, you may have some others, but let's take a look at kind of the menu of options that they've put forward. So first and foremost, we've talked already here and it's gotten a lot of coverage, the kinks in global supply chains. And you were saying a moment ago that what we've got, especially in the US, is more savings, more funds for consumers to use to spend on stuff, and a mismatch of that demand for stuff and the amount of stuff that we can bring to market. So what about strengthening global supply chains? Is that something that you think is worth focusing on, and how could we do it?
Yeah, I think the supply chain issues are really key here. If you want to think about supply chains as the blood moving throughout your body, you want to make sure that there are no kinks in that system. You want to make sure that it is all going according to plan. And when you are in this kind of high pressure situation that the economy is in right now, with kind of high demand, it's like you're running a race. Your blood is pumping more. And so when you have any particular, challenge in the supply chain, any constriction in that, it is felt so much worse. And that is why we need to do everything we can to kind of continue to strengthen global supply chains. Now, that also means, making sure that we have enough workers who can drive trucks and make sure we have enough experienced people to run rail cars, to make sure that we are loading and unloading things efficiently from the ports, to make sure that the ships themselves that are coming to our shores and our ports are doing so on a timely basis. When we've had COVID resurgences in China, that slowed down that whole international side of the process. So it is this international system that we are dealing with when we're talking about supply chains. And I've been very happy to see that the New Democrat Coalition's plans involve strengthening global supply chains.
And they have two specific bills that they push for, the Bipartisan Innovation Act and one on ocean shipping reform. But it seems like the upshot of both of those is, look, to the extent that our supply chains are kinked and that they're long, that we're dependent on bringing stuff, our stuff, boy, this sounds like a park and rec routine. Like it's like food and stuff. It's where I get my food. It's where I get most of my stuff. To the extent that we're getting our stuff from Asia and Africa and Europe, if we're able to source more of it domestically, or we're able to kind of unkink some of those links that go through the oceans, that will speed things up. That will make supply lines easier and faster. Is that basically the upshot of what we can do?
Right. I think you're totally right. It's got to be a little bit of both, right? We have to deal. We know that inherently our economy is going to rely on Chinese manufactured goods and other goods manufactured in other places in Asia. Like that is going to happen. But we also can do things to encourage more production domestically so that the ship or near what we call near shoring. So maybe it's not produced in the United States, but it's produced in Mexico or Chile or Canada, right? Other folks that we know we can get things for in any sort of weird international tension, we don't have to stress too much about. And on the other hand, producing more stuff domestically, that will just take more time to do. It takes time to start new factories. It takes time for those investments to get going. So in the short term, we can do a lot to smooth supply chains while we think about what's our better strategy for domestic production or nearshore production as well.
What do you make of the second kind of general proposition that I'll shorten it to NDN, the New Democrat Network. What do you make of their second general proposition? What it seems to come down to is, look, the basic mechanism that I learned when I was an economics student back when, this was a long time ago, okay? The basic mechanism driving inflation was explained to me as, look, people expect that prices are going to go up, so they bid up their asks for their wages. And as wages go up, it becomes kind of a chain reaction. A lot of it is driven by workers asking for more money. And that's another area of the economy that's subject to supply and demand. If you have very few workers available for open jobs, if you have a tight labor market, then their relative power over their employers to say, look, I'll work, but you know, if you want me, you got to pay me more. Their relative power goes up. So one thing you can do to kind of affect that supply-demand balance is to increase the supply of labor. And that's one of the general areas that NDN pushes here. And they specifically suggest training mechanisms. And, you know, this is not going to be politically popular, but immigration policies. What do you make of the general proposition? What do you make of their specific proposals?
Yeah, that's a great question. So just stepping back for a second, a tight labor market is not on its own inherently bad, because a tight labor market brings folks who were more on the margins, less attached to the labor force, into the labor market. So folks that maybe were considering retiring and they're like, well, actually, I can earn a pretty good wage and that'll make sure I have enough money saved for retirement. It brings folks who may have some form of a disability that makes it more challenging for them to do particular types of work, and that they can get brought in and employers will invest in them.
In fact, one of the things we saw during the recession was a 2% decline in women's labor force participation. Hence, it was kind of called the she session. So that would be another area if we want to draw more women back into the labor force.
Right. Exactly. And that goes to the particular COVID related challenges of the labor market right now. It's been two things. It's been, you know, predominantly women and other caretakers are out of the labor market because, you know, kids were taking school online and, you know, you kind of need to watch your kid when they're online. You have a situation where, you know, you just, if you're worried about contracting COVID yourself, and that may mean that you're less willing to do an in-person job and you'd rather do a remote job. And then in addition, you know, we did have 4 years of the Trump administration, and that Trump administration policy was to try to decrease immigration as much as possible. And then we had COVID, where there was active public health and safety issues related with immigration. And so at that time, it's like we've this pool of new workers that would have been there, that should have been there, I would say, is not there. And so that's why immigration would help with some of these issues, because while a tight labor market is not inherently bad, it's very bad right now. And that's, you know, when employers are really, really struggling to hire folks, if they start saying, look, I am just going to raise wages and do whatever it takes, that is when we start to tip over into the self-fulfilling prophecy of inflation. And we just want to avoid that. Now, workers' wages are going up are generally good, but when they're going up because inflation, it's a lot less good.
It occurs to me that many of these proposals are not the kind of thing that, you know, you were mentioning earlier that one of the advantages of monetary policy is that it can be very fast acting and it's a lot more nimble. And when it comes to fiscal policy, what we're really talking about is things that could take effect over the course of the next year, 2 years. These aren't fast acting remedies. And that really jumps out to me when we talk about this next one here. I'm skipping around a little bit from their policy proposal, but what they point to is a need to lower energy prices now and transition to a clean energy economy. The way Larry Summers put it last week is we need to kind of follow an all-in, what we used to call an all-of-the-above energy policy right now, but not lose sight of the longer-term need to address global warming by transitioning to more support for renewables. And that's another very delicate line to walk. What do you make about that whole area? Is that something that policymakers can really effectively do? Can they really enact any changes that even over the course of a couple of years would meaningfully affect energy supplies, even of kind of traditional fuel sources? And what about that longer term pivot to clean energy?
Yeah, that's a great point. And look, if we're producing energy for your home, and it is done from a coal-fired or an oil-fired power plant, and those prices go up, your energy costs go up. But if your grid has more solar and wind, that helps offset any sort of big swings that you would have in the commodity prices and how it would affect you individually. So a clean energy transition to be able to have more wind and solar and then other advanced forms of maybe advanced nuclear plants or other lower no carbon energy production is going to be really helpful. And that's what the new Dem plan is really calling for. Let's fix the short term. Let's do more releases from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Let's make sure that market participants have the certainty so that they're willing to make the capital investments to pump more oil and natural gas in the short term while we do the things to set us up for, you know, the 5-10 years down the road to electrify and do all the other good stuff to combat global climate change.
Just hopscotching around a little bit on their list, they focus on kind of day-to-day costs, out-of-pocket costs for Americans, and there's sort of a grab bag here of things that people spend a large portion of their family budget on, where you could make small, sometimes somewhat larger changes. For example, the child tax credit, which provides financial assistance for fundamental needs, you know, to take care of your kids so that you can go to work. So you're kind of hitting two birds with one stone. It's kind of a family expense. And it's also enabling that labor force, that supply issue that we were just talking about. Or another thing that Larry Summers was advocating for, the cost of prescription drugs. This was something that Democrats were trying to address in the Build Back Better Act before that fell apart. But they still have the ability to pass a budget resolution that could include reforms to prescription drug prices or cap the cost of insulin. What do you make of those? Are those meaningful steps that Congress could take? Or are they more kind of meaningful economically, but also psychologically impactful?
I think you're right that it's the latter, right? I think it's both meaningful for your pocketbook. If you are someone who needs childcare so that you can work, reducing childcare costs absolutely affects your pocketbook. If you are someone who takes prescription drugs, or you're a senior who has a variety of prescription drug benefits that you get through Medicare Part D, reductions in those prescription drug prices absolutely affect you. If you drive a lot and gas prices get cheaper, that absolutely affects you. But it may not necessarily affect every single person in the economy. But like you said earlier, the economy is all of us. And so as we all kind of ladder up to everything, that's enough to make everyone feel a little bit better about inflation. Now, it may, you know, these policies themselves may not directly lower the consumer price index or however we measure inflation, but they will lower how it impacts all of us more directly.
I want to go a little bit off label from the NDN menu here and talk, boy, I've mentioned Larry Summers an awful lot here, but you know, he's on the brain here. Another thing that he suggested that's worth talking about here is the role of tax policy. And he recommended a partial repeal of the Trump tax cuts to reduce demand. When you cut taxes, you're putting more money in people's pockets. And that's part of the issue here, is this mismatch. A lot of money for people to spend. That means a lot of demand, not enough supply. Boom. You know, you've got dollars chasing goods that aren't there. It seems to me, and let me, I want to run this by you as sort of a two-parter. So the first part is, what do you think about that approach? And is it also kind of, is that kind of aiming at the dynamic that we've talked about with tax cuts for a long time, which is when you cut taxes, it really matters. It really matters who's benefiting. And one of the problems with the Trump tax cuts is that they were so tilted toward the upper brackets in the income tax spectrum that you're putting money in the pockets of people who are not going to go out and spend it. They're going to tend to save it. Is that part of the dynamic here as well, that what you want to do is you want to not have so much money in the hands of people who are definitely going to go out and spend it?
Yeah. So I guess this is a little complicated here, because, you know, if we were to cut taxes for everybody right now, you know, folks on the lower end, you know, working class folks are going to go spend it because, you know, gas prices are really high right now. And food prices are going up. They're going to spend it on that. Well, and then that would potentially increase in inflation. You know, a higher income individual, you know, a lawyer or a doctor, they may not spend it. And that means it's a little bit less in inflationary in general. When I think about tax policy and its role in combating inflation, it's about making sure, step one is about making sure that whatever investment you need to make for the future to increase the supply of housing, to increase the supply of domestically manufactured silicon chips, to make sure that people have the workforce training that they can get this, so that they can have the skills to succeed in the future. Tax policy plays a role to making sure that you are funding all of that important government spending, all of those investments. So therefore, that investment is not itself increasing inflation at the same time. So there's an absolutely a role for tax policy there. And on the other side, on aggregate, if we have deficit reduction, either through spending cuts or tax increases, that will generally mellow out economic activity, which will help fight inflation.
As we head toward the end of the show, I want to really go off the hit list here and sort of turn to you for your general economic expertise. Third Way tends, and you tend to advocate for policies that invest long-term in the economy, in workers, in growth. And that's sort of, you know, it's right back to that issue of the balance that we need to strike here. Are there particular policies that are sort of pet favorites of yours or of Third Ways that you think fit into the picture here that are both good for fighting inflation and also good for that long-term economic trajectory that we want to get onto?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the top ones is making sure we're creating a more skilled labor force, making sure that if you get out of high school, you can go get technical training to do the next big thing, or, you know, whether that's installing clean energy products, whether that is making sure that, you know, you are equipped to be a plumber and remove lead pipes from schools. You know, if these are long-term things we want to do, we need to have workers to do them. We've invested all this money to modernize our infrastructure, including expanding broadband, but will we have the labor force to do all of that? And so making sure that we have a more skilled labor force is going to be really important. That Congress is working on something called the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. This is WIOA. The House has passed it. We're waiting to see if the Senate is going to pass it this year. That includes modernizing and boosting funding for job training, which can also include something for apprenticeships, which is like a work, an earn and learn model to make sure that, you know, you're learning the skills while you are also getting paid to do that learning. That's something that we're advocating for a lot at Third Way. In addition, we got to tackle childcare. Childcare is very expensive in this country, and making sure that we have proper investments so that more families can afford childcare, that there are more childcare slots for folks to have, means that we can actually make sure that more parents are working and in the labor force, and they can earn a better life for their kids. Those are kind of two things that come to mind.
Do you see a prospect, based on your long experience working in Congress, do you see a prospect for passing any of these critical pieces for our economic future anytime in this session of Congress?
So fundamentally, we are at this point where we have a budget reconciliation bill available. This is the fast track process that Congress used to pass the American Rescue Plan. They've set it up to pass Build Back Better, but Build Back Better as it's currently constructed is dead. But the vehicle is still alive until October 1st. So this is an opportunity to make reforms to the tax code to make sure higher income individuals pay their fair share and help offset the cost of investments we want to make. We invest in the future of a clean energy economy, and we do something on healthcare costs, right? Those three pieces, that absolutely has a path forward. I am just really hopeful that Congress can set aside some big egos and get it done.
There's been a lot of discussion about executive orders. Are there policy elements here that are either core to your economic program or to the inflation fighting agenda that President Biden could do and should do on his own absent action from Congress?
So there's actually a few things the president can do. The president has a lot of discretion over tariff policy or taxes that Americans and American businesses pay on imports from abroad. So a lot of these tariffs were increased under the Trump administration, and President Biden has an opportunity to evaluate what has worked and what hasn't worked. And in my opinion, most of it hasn't worked, to start rolling back some of these Trump era tariffs. And that should pass some savings along to consumers and American businesses. And then in addition, the president needs to not make things worse. There are definitely things that the president could do that would juice the economy in the wrong way at the same time. So we just have to be cautious here about everything we are doing.
But forgiving all student loan debt, for example.
Right. That would be something that would many people would consider inflationary. And then the president can do a lot to bring together the business communities and labor communities to make sure that supply chain issues are continuing to be addressed as well.
Very interesting stuff and incredibly important stuff. Hey, we've got 30 seconds. You're a Microsoft Excel junkie. I'm a Microsoft Excel junkie. Tell our listeners, what's your favorite Microsoft Excel trick?
Oh my goodness, my favorite Microsoft Excel trick. This is less of a trick and more of a process. So I fact check a lot of people's Microsoft Excels, and I have this big system about, I will just try to recreate it in another tab and then do like an if-then statement to say, does this match up? And so that's my like trick for checking other people's work.
Zach Mueller, first of all, you get an award for the nerdiest 30 seconds that we've ever had on this show, and I love it. Thanks so much for all of your insights, including that one.
Matt, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks for having me.